The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Through This, a site where survivors share their experiences. She says no two stories are alike. Some people have had long mental health struggles. Some had, quote-unquote, normal childhoods. Suicide isn't about the crazy person. It's about all of us. Though headlines about rising murder rates may quicken our pulses, an American is more likely to take her own life than be killed by someone else. In 2016, there were more than twice as many suicides, 44,965, as homicides, 19,362, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. We can't be quiet about this anymore, says suicidologist Julie Serrell, Ph.D., a professor at the University of Kentucky College of Social Work and president of the American Association of Suicidology. Each loss increases the risk for the entire community, as people who are close to someone who dies by suicide are more likely to then have suicidal thoughts themselves. When we hear a person has ended her life, whether she's a friend or a public figure, the question is the same. Why? Even the experts can't explain what drives certain people to suicide. Compared with other leading causes of death, suicide research is not well funded, said Serrell. Furthermore, suicidal behavior can't be replicated in a lab. Subjects may be reluctant to report suicidal thoughts, and each individual is influenced by a complex combination of variables, which may include depression, substance abuse, genetics, and negative life circumstances. Even if we're certain we'll never reach the point of ultimate despair, anyone around us could be vulnerable. We must stay alert to each other's suffering, says Alan Ross, executive director of the Samaritans of New York, which runs a crisis response hotline. Suicide prevention is not about death. It's about life, how we help people in their time of need. Sharon Greenwald, 55, New York City, attempted in 2016. I never considered that I felt worthless because I was depressed. I thought I felt depressed because I was worthless. My marriage had ended. Then, 5 years later, I was living alone in the city. My son stayed in the suburbs with my ex-husband, and my daughter was away at college. Losing my old identity and routine was terrifying. I'd sit in my apartment and think, "You're never going to have a life again." Since I was a teenager, I'd had this feeling that I deserved to be punished. When the pain got to be too much, I told myself I would end it. Meanwhile, I lived like a person without a future. I didn't paint over my ugly brown walls. Why bother? I loved dogs, but I wouldn't adopt one. I wasn't going to be around to take care of it. It didn't occur to me that I might have clinical depression because I wasn't sad 24/7. I was happy at work and when I was with my kids. I went to the Cayman Islands with friends. How could I be depressed? For 10 years, I had been planning to die. Then right before the weekend of July 4th, I thought, that's it. There's no way in hell I'm going through another holiday alone. I tied up loose ends at work, returned my company laptop. I labeled all my jewelry because I wanted my daughter to know the story behind every piece. I made a list of passwords for my ex-husband, who was the executor of my will. I texted my kids that I loved them. I was looking forward to dying. I thought, I'm going to see my father again. I left notes for everyone, including one apologizing to whoever found me. Consider it, right? Then I swallowed a large quantity of pills and said, "Dad, I'll be there soon." When I didn't show up at the office, my coworkers contacted my daughter, who called my doorman. I was rushed to the hospital, where I spent a week in a coma. The doctors weren't sure I would ever wake up. My family stayed at my bedside talking to me and playing Bruce Springsteen, my favorite. But I wasn't aware of it. The first thing I did hear was my mother's voice telling me where I was. Then I remembered what had happened, and I was so sorry. When the doctor said, "You've obviously been very depressed," it was a revelation. I hadn't realized how distorted my thoughts had become. My daughter asked me later, "How could you do this to us?" But that's how screwed up I was. I didn't think my kids would miss me. I thought they'd be sad at the funeral, and then they'd go on with their lives. A suicidal person isn't thinking about abandoning her loved ones. She just wants to end the pain. I get pissed off whenever somebody says, he had $1 billion, why would he do this? He did it because he was in pain too. As it turns out, depression runs in my family, but nobody had ever talked about it. I'm very serious about taking meds, going to therapy, practicing the mindfulness skills I've learned. I feel like I've gotten a second chance. It's funny, a few months after I got out of the hospital, I was hit by a taxi, and I was lying there in the street thinking, are you serious? This is happening now when I want to live? Fortunately, I just broke my foot. I finally painted my walls a beautiful cream and light green and got a rug in fun 60s colors. I got a dog. When I look at her lying with her little paws up in the air, it's a small thing, but it makes me so happy. That's what mindfulness has taught me. I feel my chest rising and falling, and I try to enjoy the now because the now is where I am. Ann Taylor, 55, Los Angeles, attempted in 2009 and 2012. Within a period of 18 months, both of my parents passed away and my husband asked for a divorce. Any one of those things I could have dealt with, but not altogether. I thought, you're alone in the world. I've never been diagnosed with any mental health issues besides some postpartum depression with one of my sons, but now all I wanted was to stop the pain. I lost the three people who had always had my back. I was visiting a friend who lived nearby and told her I thought I needed to check myself into a psychiatric hospital. She said she'd drive me, and I went back to my house to pack. But once I was home alone, I was so overwhelmed by anxiety that I didn't think I could live through another second. So I took every pill I could find and drank a bunch of alcohol. It was that spontaneous. I got a lot of therapy. At the time, the only other people who knew about my attempt were my ex-husband, who had to take care of the kids, and the friend who was going to drive me to the hospital, as well as her husband. She eventually disappeared from my life. She said, every time I hear an ambulance, I worry it's headed to your house. How do you think that feels? For me, that first attempt was like crossing a line. 3 years later, I attempted again when I was going through a breakup and my emotions were out of control. After I got home from the hospital, I hid for fear someone would ask what had happened. But after a year or so, I couldn't keep it a secret anymore. I started to tell people, and most were supportive. But this is a very difficult subject for friends and family to talk about. I also started going to a support group for attempt survivors that was facilitated by a therapist, as well as someone who's a survivor themselves. Just to sit with other people and get the words out of my mouth, I have attempted suicide, was such a relief. I became a peer facilitator, and I also volunteer on the crisis hotline. I think many people have suicidal thoughts at some point in their life, yet don't want to talk about it because they're trying to protect themselves. But bringing dark thoughts into the light lessens their power. Kalechi Uboza, 33, Oakland, attempted in 2009. People say suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, but some problems are in fact permanent. My grandmother died when I was 14, and I took it really hard. She was a wonderful person who loved even the darkest parts of me. After she was gone, I told a friend I wanted to die too. She told a teacher who told my mom, and I ended up in the hospital. I never wanted to go back, so I stuffed my feelings down and pretended to be the happiest, most glittery unicorn. In my 20s, I was still pretending, but inside my brain was a tornado. I was trying to realize my dream of being a journalist, but I needed two other jobs to make ends meet. I felt like I was failing everyone's expectations, including my own. I thought, you don't deserve to be here. I was feeling increasingly desperate, so I went to the hospital. They told me, you're not sick enough to be here. You're too high functioning. Maybe they were understaffed and could only take the highest risk cases. Maybe they weren't taking me seriously because I'm a black woman who presented too well. Anyway, I didn't know how to prove I was in serious trouble, and they let me go. A few weeks after that, I was raped by someone I knew. Something lit up inside me like, I've got to get out, way out, so he can't do this again. I wrote my roommates a rent check and drove to a hotel far away. I don't want to get into the details of what happened next. My mom, who's a doctor, helped me get into one of the top outpatient facilities in Georgia where she was living. The staff there was amazing. They helped me stop pretending I was okay all the time. My therapist and I did trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, and I learned to look at my thoughts, slow them down, and stop them. I'd say, "No one cares about me." She'd say, "Is that true? What about your mom?" I was very lucky. My mental health was my full-time job. Am I happy now? Well, I'm healthy. I've learned to recognize the difference, and I'm honest about it with the people I love. When I feel like I'm starting to slip, I don't mess around. Now I have a great support network. A few years ago, I had a situation. I'd called off an engagement, the negative thoughts had come flooding back, and the man who raped me tried to get in touch with me. So I put myself first. I took a month off from my job, checked into an intensive outpatient program, asked my mom to come stay with me, and dealt with my mental health. During that time, a friend did the most beautiful thing. For every one of the 30 days I took off, she gave me a gift, a chocolate, a superhero comic book, a quote. I got through it and went back to work. Stacy Friedenthal, 51, Denver, attempted in 1996. I once read that we all have a prosecutor in our head who points out the things we've done wrong, but we don't all have a strong defense attorney. Mine had gone missing entirely. I'd wake up at 3 a.m. and lie there thinking of all the ways I was defective. It could be the smallest thing, like my dirty floors. My psychiatrist wanted me to go back on medication, which I'd stopped because I had hair loss, an uncommon side effect. I just thought medication won't work. I knew all about distorted thinking. I was studying to be a therapist, and I'd even volunteered at a suicide hotline. But that's what depression does. It lies. I wrote a letter to my parents apologizing and assuring them they'd be better off without me. Then I put up a sign for the friends who had keys to my place, at eye level, so they wouldn't miss it. "Do not go into my room. To spare yourself, call 911. I'm so sorry." I thought asphyxiation would be peaceful, but the body fights back. I began gasping for air as everything was going black. Instinctively, I began struggling to free myself, panicked that I would pass out before I managed to abort the attempt. It was terrifying, but also a relief to be connected to the survival instinct. There's a theory that when a person is contemplating self-harm or suicide, she's in a dissociative state, as if she's outside her own body. Then at the moment when her life is in peril, the survival instinct kicks in and she snaps back. It's almost like thinking, "Oh my God, my mind is trying to murder me." Sometimes when people take pills and then call for help, their suicide attempt isn't considered serious. I believe every attempt is serious. I also believe that in many cases, they probably had what mental health professionals call a high intent to die. It's just that at the crucial moment, their survival instinct kicked in. This is why firearms are especially dangerous. They're instantaneous. The person never has the chance to feel that survival impulse. For years, whenever anyone asked why I focused on suicide in my work as a therapist, I gave them the partial truth, telling them a friend of mine had killed himself in high school and I wanted to help people like him. But the longer I hid, the more hypocritical I felt. So in 2017, I finally came out of the closet. I've since received so many letters from people who work in mental health, from graduate students to therapists who were in their 80s, who themselves had thought about or attempted suicide, yet never felt they could confide in anybody. I hope that can change as we diminish the stigma of suicide. Stigma means a mark of disgrace, and I refuse to abide by the notion that anyone with suicide, depression, or other mental health problems deserves a mark of disgrace. Anita Wilson, 53, New Albany, Ohio, attempted in 2012. Well-meaning Christians will say, if you're depressed, you should just pray more. Mental health issues can be taboo in the church because asking for help feels like shining a spotlight on your spiritual life and admitting that your faith isn't strong enough. When I began struggling with depression as a young woman, I didn't tell my pastor or congregation. I managed my condition with medication, but then in my late 30s, chronic illness pushed me over the edge. I began having mysterious episodes of extreme vertigo and painful inner ear pressure. I had to give up my job as a senior database marketing analyst along with my volunteer work. I spiraled downward, but I kept it to myself. I thought if you were a better Christian, you could cope. Based on some misguided advice in an online support group, I began drinking to help quell my physical symptoms. The alcohol also numbed the feelings of failure and loneliness, so I started drinking more, and abusing pills, too. One day, I just decided I couldn't take it anymore. I wrote my family a letter and tried to tape it to my bedroom door, but I'd been drinking all day, and I was so emotionally out of it, I couldn't find any tape. I used a Band-Aid. My family and I went to therapy together, and it was very healing, but I still feel so much guilt about what I put my children through. I just lost my mind. When I came to, at first I was angry that I was still alive. But a few hours later, a friend came by and hugged me and said, "I heard you were having a hard time." Even in my addled state, I could feel how loved I was. I spent 2 weeks in a facility getting psychiatric and substance abuse treatment, then did a 6-week outpatient program. When I got home, I pulled out some old journals to try to figure out how I'd fallen so far. I could see how the depression fed on itself. The worse I felt, the further I drew away from the people I loved and the spiritual practices that had always sustained me. There's a reason they call it spiritual practice. Every day I practice the things that help me feel better: prayer, meditation, gratitude, creativity. I wrote a book called Well that includes coping strategies. For my pen name, I used Alias in Town, an anagram of my name, because in every town there are those who live with hidden depression and addiction. I'm also speaking about mental health in churches. The sad surprise is the number of people who have told me they've had similar thoughts. When you're so depressed, you think you're alone, but you aren't. Today I can say, as one old hymn goes, "Even so, it is well." If you are having thoughts of suicide, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. The Samaritans, New York City's 24-hour suicide prevention center, at 212-673-3000. Or text HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741-741, the crisis text line. Our next article by Robin Thomas is titled, "Your Vote Could Save Lives." Robin Thomas, executive director of the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, urged Americans to support lawmakers who will pass legislation that reduces gun violence for a 2018 story in O, the Oprah magazine. Here she revisits the piece and shares what has changed. In 2018, after the shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, Robin Thomas, executive director of the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, wrote the following piece for O, the Oprah magazine. In it, she urged Americans to vote for lawmakers who would pass legislation to reduce gun violence. 4 years later, in the wake of the deadly shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas, it feels like nothing has changed. Thomas says much more needs to be done to save lives from gun violence. She also argues, though, that it's not completely fair to say that nothing has changed. Since Parkland, 37 states have passed 280 good gun laws, she says. That's a lot of progress at a state level, particularly in places like California, New York, New Jersey, and Delaware. And there is no doubt that laws encouraging and promoting gun safety work. States that have passed stricter gun safety laws, like California, have lower gun death rates compared to states that do not have these protections in place. Making change on a state level is key, and that means voting in elected officials who will pass legislation that keeps guns out of the hands of people who should not have them. As we approach the midterm elections in November of this year, read the below piece from Thomas to learn more about gun safety laws that can make a difference. Then, when you head to the polls, you can make sure the candidates who get your votes are aligned with the changes you'd like to see. 50 years ago, our country was in the midst of a public health crisis. Record numbers of Americans were dying at the hands of fellow citizens wielding objects of lethal destruction. Those objects? Automobiles. In 1968, almost 54,000 Americans died in car accidents. But in the decades that followed, something changed. Actually, several things. The federal government implemented new safety standards for highways, which led to guardrails, barriers, and other improvements, and for vehicles, which led to innovations like shatter-resistant windshields and airbags. States passed laws requiring the use of seat belts and child safety seats. And ordinary citizens, led by anguished mothers, rose up to promote public awareness of the risks of drunk driving and insisted on legislation to punish people who got behind the wheel after one too many drinks. On their own, none of these measures would have been enough to drastically reduce the number of fatalities on American roads. But together, that's exactly what they did. There were 51 deaths per 100,000 licensed drivers in 1968. By 2015, that number had dropped nearly 69% to 16. So now we turn our attention to a new public health crisis. In 2016, guns took the lives of 38,658 Americans. Editor's note, in 2020, that number was 45,222. They're the third leading cause of death for American children ages 1 to 17. Editor's note, in 2020, firearms were the leading cause of death among children under the age of 19. In fact, the first 5 months of 2018 were deadlier for U.S. school children than for U.S. troops in combat zones. Every year, high schools across the country park mangled cars on their grounds as a reminder to teen drivers to be safe. Yet every day when we send our kids to school, we're asking them to put their lives at risk. And school shootings are only a small part of the tragedy wrought by guns. In 2016, 59% of gun deaths in the U.S. were suicides. Firearm homicide is the leading cause of death for African-American males between the ages of 15 and 34. Female domestic violence victims whose abusers own guns are 5 times more likely to be killed than women whose abusers don't. And then there are unintentional shootings, which in 2016 took 495 lives and injured more than 21,000, many of them children and teens. For millions of Americans, the daily headlines about gun violence are grim enough to cause despair. The gun lobby is too deep-pocketed, we might tell ourselves, or Washington is too gridlocked to make meaningful change. But the truth is, this problem is not bigger than we are. Just like car accidents, gun deaths are fundamentally a health issue. And just like car accidents, they can be tackled by making practical changes on a number of fronts. We need lawmakers across the U.S. to support these 6 policies, all of which have successfully reduced gun deaths. Universal background checks. A 2017 study estimates that 22% of gun owners acquired their most recent weapon without a background check. That's because current federal law requires such checks only for people buying from licensed firearm dealers. In most states, if you buy a gun from a private seller, at a gun show, or online, you're good to go, no questions asked. Universal background checks, on the other hand, would apply to every purchase, and more than 90% of Americans support making them mandatory nationwide. This would help keep guns out of the hands of illegal buyers, felons, domestic abusers, and gun traffickers, and save lives without infringing upon Second Amendment rights. Extreme risk protection orders. In the months before the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, the gunman managed to purchase multiple assault weapons despite warnings about his potential to commit violence, including a number of 911 calls made by and about him. Extreme risk protection order laws enable law enforcement or family members to ask a court to temporarily remove a person's guns. Following the Parkland shooting, 8 states, including Florida, passed these life-saving laws. Domestic abuser firearm bans. Domestic violence assaults are 12 times more likely to result in the victim's death if they involve a gun. Of the 10,018 female intimate partner homicides between 2003 and 2014, more than half were committed with firearms. 29 states have laws prohibiting anyone convicted of a misdemeanor domestic violence offense from purchasing or possessing guns. That leaves 21 states to go. Child access prevention laws. We put childproof caps on aspirin bottles, yet for many kids, getting their hands on a gun is as easy as opening a closet door. In the future, smart guns employing technology like fingerprint scanners that are able to be fired only by authorized users may be widely available. For now, though, more than 4 million young children and teens have easy access to at least one gun in their home. Child access protection laws play a critical role in keeping kids from harm by holding gun owners liable for failing to safely secure their firearms. One study found that unintentional firearm deaths among children under age 15 fell by 23% in states where such laws had been in effect for at least a year. Urban gun violence intervention programs. Black men make up about 6.5% of the U.S. population, yet account for more than 50% of gun homicide victims. Intervention programs interrupt cycles of violence and retaliation by providing outreach and opportunity to the most at-risk members of the population before they pick up a gun. In cities including Boston, New Haven, Connecticut, and Richmond, California, urban violence intervention programs have reduced homicides by up to 60%. Regulations on assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. After the federal ban on assault weapons expired in 2004, states became responsible for regulating these dangerous military-grade weapons. Limiting access to them and to large-capacity ammunition magazines would make it much more difficult to inflict the kind of devastation that the Las Vegas shooter did last October, firing more than 1,000 rounds, which killed 58 and wounded hundreds more in a matter of minutes. 7 states have banned assault weapons, while 9 have placed limits on large-capacity magazines. Gun safety laws have tremendous power. The common-sense legislation California has implemented over the past 25 years, including an extreme risk protection order and limits on large-capacity magazines, has cut its gun death rate by more than half. And since the Parkland shooting, 57 new gun laws have been signed in 26 states. A signal that the gun lobby's hold on American politicians is weakening. Enacting these critical policies in more states and ultimately at the federal level will save thousands of innocent lives. 50 years ago, we saw that too many futures were being cut short by car accidents, and we didn't throw up our hands. We didn't write off the problem as inevitable. We didn't accept that endangering our fellow citizens was a freedom afforded us by the Constitution. Instead, we took action. Action that has since prevented hundreds of thousands of deaths. We can do the same with gun violence. We can go to the polls and vote for leaders who pledge their commitment to passing effective gun safety laws. If enough Americans choose to make saving lives a priority, there will come a day when we look back and wonder what took us so long. Our next article by Maya Ephraim is titled 15 Simple Ways to Be More Productive Every Day. Ever feel like your to-do lists are getting longer and longer, but you're less and less motivated? Between balancing your job, home life, and personal relationships, it can often seem like there must be a better way to be more productive. Well, that or there just aren't enough hours in the day. That's true in normal times, but perhaps even more so now, when amid the coronavirus pandemic and quarantining, many of us are working from home and dealing with dozens of new distractions. Think helping your kids with online school or even the pile of laundry that's suddenly more appealing than tackling your out-of-control inbox, to name a few. The good news? There are ways to be more productive, and we've spoken to a variety of experts to help you finally get time on your side. From building a better routine in the morning, to apps that'll help you stay organized, and simple strategies for managing your email, these productivity tips will help you work more efficiently, even if your office is your kitchen table, and best of all, leave you with more free moments every day. Number 1, wake up at the same time every day. Getting into a routine can be one of the best ways to stay productive, especially while working from home, says Rhiannon Staples, a corporate culture expert and CMO at people management platform Hibub. Try to wake up at similar times each day, exercise if you're accustomed to it, eat breakfast, have your morning coffee, and then sit down at your computer to start the workday. Sticking to a schedule will help you stay regimented and as alert as possible, because when you know what to expect, it's less daunting to start your day, no matter what you have on your plate, she explains. Number two, do something nice for yourself to set the tone. For Marie Kondo, Netflix star and best-selling author of The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, The Japanese Art of Decluttering and Organizing, starting the morning with good energy is important for productivity. According to Kondo, her AM ritual involves opening up the windows, burning incense, and saying a prayer. But your morning routine should be whatever leaves you feeling relaxed, energized, and motivated. Whether that's a 30-minute yoga class, writing in your journal, reading a book, meditating, or whipping up a healthy breakfast. Number three, start each day with a plan. Before you get to work in the morning, create a prioritized to-do list, says Staples. It's always best practice to tackle the toughest, most difficult items first. The tricky things are easy to push off and procrastinate, but if you're successful, you'll gain the confidence and momentum to get through the rest of your list. Number four, unplug in the morning and the evening. If you mindfully go on Twitter with a glass of wine, that's fine. But you interrupt your focus when you check your phone during those in-between moments, says organizing consultant and time-to-parent author Julie Morgenstern, which is exactly why, at the minimum, you should avoid using your devices during the first and last hour of each day. If you need some ideas for what to do instead, consider working on a challenging jigsaw puzzle, opening up a coloring book, learning how to knit, playing a board game, starting a bullet journal, creating a vision board, or, of course, picking up a riveting read. Number five, while you're at work, make your phone less distracting. Need a little help avoiding the temptation to check all those entertaining social media apps? In addition to turning off your notifications, you may find it helpful to change your phone's display to grayscale, which removes all color from the screen, reducing stimulation. For a more aggressive approach to unplugging, you could also download Flipped, a free app that allows you to lock your phone for a set period of time so you can focus completely on your work or studying. Number six, set an intention before each activity. Morgenstern advises you to be mindful before switching tasks. After putting the kids to sleep, for example, take a minute to decide how you'd like to connect with your partner, be it by talking about the day, watching a movie, or getting to know each other even better. At work, choose to really enjoy a lunch or coffee break. This will help recharge your mind and increase your effectiveness before the next transition. Number seven, stick to one master calendar. Forget post-its and scattered notes. Morgenstern recommends merging all of your tasks and appointments into one calendar or scheduling system that makes you comfortable. A to-do list that is not integrated into a schedule rarely gets done, she says. Number eight, plan your weeks every Friday. Vanderkam recommends taking stock of next week's schedule every Friday afternoon in order to delegate tasks, move unnecessary meetings, and leave room for anything time sensitive. Number nine, limit meetings. With work from home, inevitably comes a flurry of Zoom meetings throughout the day. It's an important part of staying connected. But too many mismanaged appointments on your calendar can negatively impact productivity, says Staples. Try to limit meetings to 30 to 45 minutes to keep attention focused on the task at hand, she suggests. And be mindful of invites you accept. If your role in the meeting is unclear or you don't have an active role in the meeting, it's fair to ask the organizer if it's necessary for you to participate. Find you're getting invited to way too many meetings? Block some of your most productive hours out on your calendar. Number 10, download an organization app to help you at home or work. If the calendar method hasn't been helping you achieve peak productivity, it might be time to download an organization app. According to executives and productivity coaches, these apps help you manage multiple to-do lists, organize your address book, track your time, easily access your passwords, prioritize your well-being, and track various assignments, all of which will increase focus and productivity. Number 11, schedule time just for checking emails. According to a 2017 American Psychological Association survey, constantly checking and responding to emails, even on your days off, leads to increased stress. If you find yourself becoming one of those constant checkers, try setting predetermined time frames for opening up your inbox. Allotting 20 minutes every hour for responding to messages might just lower stress and help you get more done for the remaining 40 minutes. Number 12, maybe spend less time responding to emails. When you are in email mode, whittling down your email responses to 5 sentences or less will help you succinctly deliver the thoughts you're trying to convey and cut the time spent writing them. To prevent coworkers or friends from thinking your responses are rude, Chris Bailey, author of Hyperfocus, recommends letting people know you're doing this by adding a line in your email signature like, "To respect your time and mine, I'm keeping every email to 5 sentences or less." Number 13, take frequent breaks every day. If you don't give your brain a break, you may end up in an internet rabbit hole instead of working, says off-the-clock author and time management speaker Laura Vanderkam, who suggests incorporating short breaks into your workday. During that time, go for a walk, take the dogs outside, grab a cup of coffee or a snack, check in with a friend or family member, do a quick at-home workout, or listen to a new podcast. Number 14, prioritize self-care. Being too busy is often an excuse for shying away from exercise and hobbies you love, but putting yourself first is essential. Vanderkam and Morgenstern agree that looking after your mental health in small intervals is useful. Watch a 10-minute YouTube video that makes you smile, enjoy a cup of chamomile tea, listen to a good song, light a scented candle, and indulge in some well-deserved self-care. Number 15. Make the most of the weekend. Decide whether you'd like to conquer demands in the mornings, afternoons, or evenings. Morgenstern says this can help you juggle your relationship with family, friends, and yourself, while also weaving in moments for pesky chores and overdue professional tasks. Be sure to also outline time to do, well, absolutely nothing. Our next article by Sarah Fay is titled, "I Am So Much More Than a Diagnosis." My first diagnosis came at age 12. I hadn't been eating much for months, then nothing for 4 days. Then I couldn't hold down food or water. In the car on the way to the hospital, my mother gripped the steering wheel and cried, "What do you think you're doing?" Her voice was tight with panic. I didn't have an answer for her then or in the cold examination room as I stepped on the scale and the doctor flicked the weight lower and lower until it balanced. The cheery expression he'd greeted us with faded. "Anorexia nervosa," he said, his tone authoritative. As a girl, not yet a teenager, I didn't think to question him, a man wearing a lab coat with a stethoscope hanging around his neck. Until that moment, I'd never even heard the word anorexia. It was the 1980s, long before thinspo websites and pro-Anna Instagram accounts idealized and encouraged the disorder. A therapist later told me the classic symptoms, none of which I'd exhibited. I never weighed myself, counted calories, or thought of myself as fat. It's not that something wasn't wrong, it was. What I was doing was extreme, even dangerous, but it seemed logical to me. My parents were divorcing, and I was about to attend a new school. I was extraordinarily sad and terrified. That sadness and terror gave me a stomach ache, and because of that stomach ache, which seemed to encompass me, I didn't want to eat. It may have been an attempt at control, an oft-cited reason for anorexia, but I wasn't conscious of doing so if it was. For the next 30 years, I battled many of the emotions, thoughts, and behaviors that characterize the human experience. Depression, anxiety, agitation, psychic discomfort, obsessiveness, insomnia, overindulgence, fear, distractibility, despair, and more. I also experienced some that aren't as common: social isolation, self-hatred, depersonalization, derealization, hyperactivity, and suicidality. My struggles were severe. Most often, my diagnoses came from primary care physicians during annual visits. I didn't see a psychiatrist until I was in my 40s. At various times, I was told that I had generalized anxiety disorder, or GAD, major depressive disorder, or MDD, obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and bipolar disorder, sometimes in combination, sometimes individually. A diagnosis can bring relief and even feel like a lifeline, but for me, it wasn't that straightforward. Once I was given a diagnosis, it became the focus. It was the reason for my distressing thoughts, overwhelming emotions, and undesirable behaviors. All other aspects of my life were secondary. If a mental disorder was me and the reason for my thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, it must hold the key to my mental health. But none did. In some ways, each diagnosis was a self-fulfilling prophecy. I identified so strongly with it that I came to embody it. It didn't help that I was told I was anorexic and bipolar, not that I had them. With the depression diagnosis, I saw myself as a depressed person. The anxiety diagnosis made me even more anxious. With the ADHD diagnosis came the belief that I was simply someone who was easily distracted and had trouble paying attention. The OCD diagnosis made me pay greater attention to my obsessions, which intensified my compulsive behaviors. As someone with bipolar disorder, I believe my surges of energy and periods of inertia were manic highs and depressive lows. Thinking of myself as a diagnosis encouraged me to deem myself incapable and set limits on what I could accomplish. Although I received an MFA and a PhD, eventually taught writing at various universities, published in reputable magazines and newspapers, and eventually wrote a book on the subject, I often couldn't function. Academia is one of the most accommodating work environments. In my 40s, I could no longer live independently. I was one of the lucky ones in that my mother let me live with her. I sat in my new psychiatrist's office. It was January. Chicago was experiencing a polar vortex. Although Dr. R's office was warm, I still felt cold to the bone. On the glass desk sat only a laptop. The bookshelf held only a couple dozen books and a few ornamental sculptures, sleek and efficient. Dr. Orr wore black pants and a crisp white-collared shirt. He was energetic, verging on buoyant. Animatedly, he pointed in my direction. Water? I felt like I was cracking and falling into a deep hole, and water seemed like a tremendous effort. I wanted help, a solution, fast. No thank you. 27 minutes, the length of that appointment, wasn't enough time to describe exactly how my mind seemed to be splintering, so I mainly gave him my mental health history, a laundry list of my diagnoses. When our session ended, I waited for him to proclaim my new diagnosis or validate my current one, bipolar disorder, as if from on high. He didn't. He just sat there as if deep in thought. Finally, I asked him what he thought I had. He glanced at the ceiling and then back at me and shrugged, "I don't know what you have." "I don't know." No clinician had ever said those words to me. They doled out their assessments quickly and with aplomb. Most had come during a 15-minute annual visit. Dr. R and I decided on the time of my next appointment, and I walked out into the bitter cold. I don't know. How could he not know? Icy snow lined the sidewalk. Cars and taxis honked their horns. The world seemed harsher, but also clearer, crisp. By the time I reached the corner and waited for the walk sign to cross Michigan Avenue, my mind started to spin in a healthful, inquisitive way. Where did mental health diagnoses come from? What are they? Who discovered them? I went home to my tiny apartment that looked out onto a brick wall, determined to learn everything about mental health diagnoses. And research I did. In the blue light of my computer screen, I dove into Google Scholar, reading meta-analysis of scientific studies. I devoured book after book written by psychiatrists, researchers, sociologists, and medical historians. What I discovered came as a shock. The mental health diagnoses we receive aren't born of scientific discoveries. They're theories written in a book, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, often referred to as psychiatry's Bible. The DSM is based on the opinions of its authors, who have historically been white men, typically members of the American Psychiatric Association, or APA, not science. I'd spent 30 years in the mental health system and had never heard of the DSM. I wondered if any of the 46% of American adults and 20% of American children and adolescents who will receive at least one DSM diagnosis in their lifetimes had either. What I discovered next was practically destabilizing. Unlike most diagnoses in medicine, mental health diagnoses aren't 100% valid. Validity, the most fundamental principle in medicine, would mean that DSM diagnoses could be precisely measured and determined. They can't. No biological markers distinguish between what's normal and what's pathological. No objective measure, no blood test, x-ray, or biopsy can show a person has the diagnosis given. Exceptions to the above are dementia and rare chromosomal disorders. Diagnoses are based entirely on a patient's self-reported symptoms and a clinician's opinion. DSM diagnoses also have little reliability. Reliability means that multiple clinicians presented with the same patient can rely on the symptoms listed in the DSM and agree on the patient's diagnosis. With mental health diagnoses, that's not the case. Based on the clinical picture, doctors are just giving us their best guess. It took me a moment to realize that none of this meant that mental illness isn't real, just that the diagnoses we received shouldn't be taken as the gospel truth, particularly in milder cases where the level of dysfunction is difficult to gauge. The DSM can't define dysfunction, so anyone can receive a diagnosis. As a woman, I had other reasons to be skeptical. Women are the largest consumers of mental health care. The fifth edition of the DSM defines sex differences as variations attributable to an individual's reproductive organs and XX or XY chromosomal complement, and gender differences as variations that result from biological sex as well as an individual's self-representation that includes the psychological, behavioral, and social consequences of one's perceived gender. We're more likely to be prescribed antidepressants, treated with electroconvulsive therapy, and hospitalized. We're more than twice as likely as men to receive mental health services, i.e., a DSM diagnosis. The statistic implies that women have more mental disorders, but it only demonstrates that women receive more DSM diagnoses. We tend to be diagnosed with depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder, diagnoses that are often stigmatized as signs of someone who's neurotic. I stared at the brick wall outside my window. As someone who was a women's studies major in college and who identifies as a feminist, I should have been on to this. Feminist groups have been protesting gender bias in the DSM since the 1980s. For example, the proposed diagnosis of masochistic personality disorder, renamed self-defeating personality disorder, seemed to justify violence against women by implying that some women enjoy being abused. Borderline personality disorder, or BPD, and other stigmatizing disorders often stereotype women as mad, difficult, hysterical, and crazy. My doctors had all been men except one. Was their gender why I didn't question them or press them for more information? Or was it that as Americans, we tend not to question physicians because they know best? In terms of the latter, I simply hadn't a clue about the limitations of mental health diagnoses. Now that I did, my life changed. My mental health was something I finally had agency over, not just as someone who'd spent the majority of her life in the mental health system, but as a woman. I still see Dr. R and take my medication as directed. It took a year, but eventually I revealed to him all I'd learned about the DSM. My hesitation to discuss it with him came partly from gender conditioning and because I worried he wouldn't want to be my psychiatrist anymore. He was the only clinician who'd been honest with me. When I explained that I was writing a memoir that was partly an investigation into the DSM, he threw up his hands. "The DSM," he said with dismay, "it's a mess." We have since talked about the DSM at length. He's been transparent about its flaws and controversies, but believes that psychiatry is the finest of professions. At my most recent appointment, he asked how I was doing. I characterized parts of my life as great and said I was feeling strong, words I didn't think I'd ever use to describe myself. When mental health diagnoses first became standardized in the mid-19th and first half of the 20th centuries, they were meant only for doctors. They served as a kind of shorthand for clinicians to communicate with each other about patients. Patients rarely knew what they were diagnosed with. Diagnoses were never intended for us to use as a lens to understand ourselves, others, and the world. There's so much more to us as women than that. Our next article by Lane Dalfin is titled, I dreamed that my nail broke and I was upset. What does this mean? I dreamed that I broke a nail and was very fixated on it. It was my right thumbnail. In the dream, I was frustrated with myself for not having been more careful and upset that I would have to wait for it to grow back. I was fixated and staring at it, but I was also looking for the broken piece and wondering if I would be able to glue it back on. Signed, Broken Thumbnail. Dear Broken Thumbnail, when I think about your dream, I envision you examining your thumbnail by holding up your thumb and making a thumbs up sign. Then right behind that first thought is the fact that your nail is broken. The broken thumbnail makes me wonder if this dream is a story of the good news and the bad news. If that were to happen to me, the bad news would be my nail broke, and the good news is it's my thumb and easy to hide. If you're a person who polishes your nails, does this thought ring true for you? Maybe breaking a thumbnail wouldn't be so important for precisely that reason. If this is the case, you might ask yourself why you seem so over-focused on it in the dream. Is there some situation that bothers you in your waking life but may not deserve the attention you were giving it? Here's another way to view the situation. Ask yourself if something in your life is recently broken in a way that doesn't show. Or does a part of you feel broken or hurt, but you haven't expressed your feelings about the matter? To add insult to injury, you seem to feel some responsibility for the break as you say to yourself, I should have been more careful. Does this resonate with you concerning a recent experience? The scenario brings to mind a friend of mine who is known for her strength, challenging another friend to an arm wrestle. My friend lost, and for the rest of the evening was the butt of the winner's jokes. Everyone laughed, including her, but inside her feelings were hurt, as some of the jokes went too far. Especially because it was my friend who initiated the challenge, she sat silent and never expressed to the joke teller how he made her feel. If you don't worry about polish and how your nails appear, you probably have different associations with a broken nail. Since we use our thumbs so often, perhaps you employed this metaphor as a way of describing some disruption in your recent waking experience. After all, it's disruptive and inconvenient to have a broken thumbnail. Following the feelings in a dream is often just what you need to find the event you are problem solving. You express that you are frustrated with yourself and upset about the wait for the nail to grow back. Can you connect to an event in your life that has left you feeling frustrated with yourself and upset by the delay it has caused? Finally, no matter which way you connect your dream or how you care for your nails, it seems it's not a major life issue, but rather a temporary annoyance. Moreover, with 9 unbroken nails, your focus seems to be on what's wrong instead of what's right. If this were my dream, I might begin by asking myself if my dream is pointing me to a lack of appreciation or thankfulness about something I am over-focused on. A shift in focus to thankfulness and appreciation can help us get through irritating events. This isn't to downplay the very real negative impact of temporary disruptions. No matter how we may try, a broken nail will still get in the way of our normal activities. There's no escaping the wait until a new one grows in. In fact, even if we glue and repair and make it seem okay, it's not. There still will be a waiting period. When something is broken, there is no avoiding that we need time to heal. However, the wait for healing can be helped by focusing on what feels good and right around you right now. When you have identified the life issue that triggered this dream, you can turn to the situation of a broken thumbnail to seek solutions. Remember, as I pointed out earlier, a broken nail is an annoyance but not a life-threatening event. It can be patched temporarily so that it's not in danger of injuring you and will eventually grow back good as new. The waiting period is annoying, of course, and might feel like a long time, but it does come to an end. And in the meantime, you can call to mind all your healthy nails, all the reasons you have to feel grateful and to move forward. We'll end this week with Oprah's announcement of her latest book club pick. Her new Oprah's book club selection is Nightcrawling by Lila Motley, published by Knopf. Motley, who was about to be 20, began her astonishing debut novel when she was just 16. It has already received pre-publication raves from such luminaries as Dave Eggers, Kesey Lehman, and James McBride. When Oprah first encountered the book, she quickly opted to name it her 96th Oprah Book Club pick. She was struck by the author's power to convey, in vivid and precise language, trauma, love, and everything in between. It always brings me joy to help introduce new writers to the reading community, and this young poet wowed me with her ode and elegy to Oakland, and her acute and insightful depictions of youth, injustice, the legacy of incarceration, and the resilience of community and chosen family. Motley, who in 2018 was named Oakland's Youth Poet Laureate, drew inspiration for the novel from true stories about sex trafficking and exploitation and the violence directed toward Black women she's experienced and witnessed in her home city. But the lyricism she brings to the tale of protagonist Kiara's desperate attempts to ward off homelessness is singular and indelible. She completed the novel in one summer after graduating early from high school. Through her and the rest of Motley's characters, Marcus, Trevor, Dee, Ale, and so many others, she's provided a gut-wrenching portrait of what it is to have all the odds stacked against you, to face the unimaginable, and somehow find the will to transcend. These lines from a poem by Motley, words she composed after a young Black woman had her throat slashed on an Oakland subway, are why the young writer felt compelled to write this novel. Every panic attack has become a memorial, and yet nothing is buried. Every Black woman in Oakland be a walking altar. The unimaginable and somehow find the will to transcend. These lines from a poem by Motley, words she composed after a young Black woman had her throat slashed on an Oakland subway, are why the young writer felt compelled to write this novel. Every panic attack has become a memorial, and yet nothing is buried. Every Black woman in Oakland be a walking altar. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.